This is Christopher Mayhew introducing this week's London Forum. One of our greatest worries today in the free countries is the wide difference of view between India, United States and Britain on the Far Eastern crisis. Today, while I'm sitting in a BBC studio in London, Shiva Rao is sitting in a studio in New Delhi in India, and John Fisher is in another studio in New York. And together we're going to try and sort out some of the problems and disagreements which worry us and which worry the peoples of our respective countries. Now, Shiva Rao, you served in the Indian Embassy in Washington, and we know your writings on current affairs. And you're the brother of Sir Benegal Rao, who's been working so hard at the United Nations in the cause of peace.
Well, I've been a member of the Indian delegation to the United Nations General Assembly for the last 4 years.
Well, that's fine, Mr. Rao, and you're ready to put an Indian point of view.
Well, yes.
Grand. And now from New York, I'm going to call in John Fisher, a journalist and writer who's had long experience in government service and an expert on American foreign policy. I believe, John Fisher, you also know India, don't you?
Yes, I served in India for about a year during the war.
Well, that's grand. Well, now, I suggest that we start off by a very general statement of our view on this Far Eastern crisis. We've differed a good deal, I know. Now, John Fisher, what do you feel about these differences of view?
There has been a good deal of concern in the United States within the last few weeks about the apparently growing divergence between British and American and Indian viewpoints on the Far East. Most Americans believe, I think, that if our best hope of avoiding war is to meet aggression frankly and firmly wherever it may occur, and that any faltering is likely to precipitate a general conflict. And we hope that our natural allies will share that point of view with us.
Yes. What do you say about that, Shiva Rao?
Well, I think there's one point which people in the United States forget, and that is on fundamentals. We agree, the British and the people in the United States and in India, for instance, in our conviction in the democratic way of life. The disagreement at the present moment tends to obscure that fundamental agreement. That, I think, is a matter which should gain the attention of the people in the United States.
I imagine we're all agreed that, of course, aggression must be prevented and stopped by all means when it occurs. It's a question of how we can do it, I think. Maybe as far as this Far Eastern situation is concerned, we do best to consider first the fundamental question, I think. What's the nature of the Chinese communist regime? What are the Chinese out for? What are their motivations? I was at Lake Success a week or two back, and I heard tremendously different points of view on this. I remember Mr. Warren Austin saying for the United States that the Chinese intervention in Korea was part of a worldwide communist plot against the United Nations. But others I spoke to, including Indians, had quite a different view, that fear was part of the motivation of that intervention, and that the regime wasn't just a regime imposed by Russia, but was a genuine social revolution of Asian peoples against a corrupt and reactionary regime. Well, now, I don't know, but Shiva Rao, you're nearest to China, and I think the Indians always pride themselves, perhaps with some justice, on understanding the Asian point of view. What have you got to say on that?
Well, in so far as that aspect is concerned, I think I have the benefit of having met General Wu at Lake Success not many weeks ago. And I got the very clear impression from the Chinese delegation which visited Lake Success that they were anxious for a settlement by negotiation and what you call aggression in Korea. We prefer to think it's the result of fear of aggression against themselves. But fear may be mistaken or it may be justified. But their action was motivated by fear, and therefore we would rather not call the Chinese the aggressors in Korea.
I see. John Fisher, do you agree with what Mr. Warren Austin said about the nature of this intervention?
Yes, in general I do. I think it would be a mistake to say that the present regime in China had been imposed by Russia. I think it was the outgrowth of a genuine, nationalistic and social revolution. But I think it as so many revolutions do, has taken a decidedly aggressive turn. Perhaps there is some analogy between the French Revolution, which started out as a indigenous social movement and developed into a very serious case of imperialism under Napoleon. Most Americans are quite sympathetic, I think, to the aspirations of the Chinese people, but are not very sympathetic to their imposing a communist regime on the other peoples of Asia or the West.
Yes. I do think there are a number of British people who accept that fear was part of the motive for Chinese intervention. I also think that a number of us feel that the difference between fear on the one hand and aggressiveness on the other is not so far, it's not so far apart as some people sometimes think. We believe that these Chinese communists are Marxists, perhaps more crude and more doctrinaire than the Russians themselves. And for Marxists, believing in the inevitability of conflict, the difference between aggression and defense becomes rather academic. The duty of weakening and undermining your opponent is paramount. But besides fear, therefore, we also feel that there is a sense of mission about these Chinese in Asia, and not only a sense of mission to liberate Asia, so to speak, as they put it, from Europeans and Americans, but in Burma, in India even, a sense of mission to support communism in those countries. And therefore the motivation has fear and aggressiveness inside it. How do you feel about that, Shiva Rao?
Well, there are two points I would like to make in regard to this. In the first place, as was pointed out at Lake Success by the Indian representative a few days ago, we cannot quite see the logic of denying the Chinese a seat in the United Nations and at the same time branding them as aggressors. But apart from that, we feel in India, and I think that feeling is shared by a great many people in other countries of Asia, we have more reason to fear that poverty and distress and hunger and starvation and lack of education and these things constitute greater dangers than any propaganda from outside. In other words, we are more afraid of the wolf at the door or within rather than the wolf outside, even assuming for the purpose of argument that it is a wolf.
Yes.
About that we are not certain at all.
What is your interpretation, Shiva Rao, of the relations between China and Russia? We can't call them satellites, you'd say, I suppose.
Well, quite frankly, I do not know enough about their relations, but I have reasons to believe from such information that is available to me that the Chinese cannot be properly called Russia's satellite in the sense in which possibly some of the other countries of Europe are. We feel that the new China is trying hard to strike out a line for herself.
I think we British feel that the issues at stake here are tremendous. I don't know of anything which could transform the whole world balance of power more quickly and certainly than some assertion of independence by China away from Russia. And in view of the huge stakes at issue, we are very reluctant to take actions which would drive the Chinese more firmly into the camp of the Soviet Union. But at the same time, we can't quite share the optimism of some Indian spokesmen on this issue. We know of no hard facts to suggest that there is a movement towards independence in China today. How do you feel yourself, John Fisher?
We would welcome, too, I think, any sign of independence that might show up in China. But we've looked very hard and haven't seen any so far. And I think we are, most of us, convinced that if the Chinese succeed in driving the United Nations forces out of Korea, that they will then turn towards Indochina and Malaya and eventually towards Burma and India. And that the chief hope of maintaining Indian independence, among other things, is to resist that aggression where it now stands. We sometimes are a little afraid that the Indians are over-optimistic about the Chinese because the Chinese are fellow Asiatics, that perhaps they feel that no Asiatic could be dangerous to another Asiatic, regardless of his politics. And the American view, I think, is that a communist power is always dangerous, no matter what its racial complexion may be. Would you think that a fair statement, Mr. Rao?
Well, what you call over-optimism is, I'm afraid, on your side, not on ours. because what exactly is the position that India takes in this matter? We feel that if China were admitted into the United Nations and participated in all the debates that take place in the United Nations, made direct contact with the other countries of the world, and not only with Russia and the group which goes with Russia, in course of time, China may come round to a different point of view. I do not say that that is necessarily going to happen, but at any rate, there is a good chance of it happening. Now, what's the alternative? To keep China out of the United Nations, to compel her to seek assistance and friendships only from the Soviet group. And I say that it is the United States which is over-optimistic. If it thinks that China can be cured of what you call communism or Marxism by any physical force, because China is a very large country with hundreds of millions of people, and we do not think that the process is going to lead to any satisfactory results.
We do think in Britain that one of the things which is disastrous from the point of view of encouraging the Chinese to seek some independence from Russia is the continued support of Chiang Kai-shek by many elements in the United States, and the recognition of the regime by the United States government. We look on Chiang Kai-shek as a completely discredited regime. Chiang Kai-shek and his followers fought badly against the communists and governed atrociously. Today they represent nobody. The support that is given to Chiang Kai-shek seems to us to have no other effect than to consolidate the Red regime with the Chinese people and to drive Red China closer into the arms of the Soviet Union. Is the support for Chiang Kai-shek dying down in the United States, would you say, John Fisher? Or is it as much as it was when I was there a fortnight ago?
As I understand it, Mr. Mayhew, the position you have stated is very close to that of the United States government. I believe our State Department has condemned Chiang Kai-shek in terms just as strong as your own. There is some support for Chiang Kai-shek in the opposition parties, in one rather small wing, I believe, of the Republican Party. The question of Formosa, I think, is quite different from the question of Korea and of admission of China to the UN. You will remember that on many occasions, American spokesmen have taken the position that the future of Korea should be a question to be decided by the United Nations. Our interest, I think, is not to keep Chiang Kai-shek in Formosa, but to keep Formosa from falling into hostile hands.
But you still recognize Chiang Kai-shek?
Yes, in default of something better.
Well, surely, I found in America, Mr. Fisher, that so many people thought that when you recognized a regime, it meant that you approved of it, you approved of its actions. And, of course, our recognition of communist China, as I explained to many American friends, doesn't in the least imply approval of Chinese communism any more than your recognition of the Soviet Union implies that you approve of the Soviet Union. It's a well-known argument. And you went on recognizing the Soviet Union after the rape of Czechoslovakia, though you won't. You stick at the recognition of the established fact, I think, that this Red regime does exercise control in China. However, I think maybe we should move on a little in the argument now. And I want to ask Shiva Rao what he thinks the Chinese are going to do next. That's to say, we've now got a lull in the fighting in Korea. To us in London, it looks as though the Chinese had overreached themselves from the military point of view. They are suffering, we understand, from typhus and frostbite on a large scale. And with the weather favoring us, we have won, I think, a considerable military success there recently.